things go well, you know, we could squeeze another one in April. So if you want to do that, if you're serious about doing that, go ahead and fill that form out, because we want to pick the new date. And any questions about that?
No.
Good. It feels warm in here still.
Okay,
sorry. We're wasting heat. Okay. And let's see. So that was one of our housekeeping things. There's a couple that I didn't get to. Let's see. Okay, so let's do this. Let's talk a little bit about what we've done and where we're headed in the course. We've got an interesting chapter on, nutrition science. We've got an interesting chapter on proteins. So we'll kind of look. We'll kind of work through that. But let's see if there's any food news. Any food news? Anybody? I have a couple of things for you. Nothing too consequential. But let's see. Came across a couple of things that are interesting. Crowd cow. Very interesting. So this is a farm in Curtis, Washington, that's doing a kind of, they're selling kind of by the cow. I'm not sure how they're actually determining a share, but it's pretty interesting. It's 100% grass-fed, grass-finished supplier. I'm kind of tempting my friends to try it, because I don't eat meat at the moment, but I really want to, if any of you, those of you who do eat meat, and if you could consider doing this, it's not the cheapest meat you'll find, but it looks pretty good. It looks pretty good quality. So if anybody wants to do it, one of the things that we're going to get into a little more this part of the term is gastronomy, which involves food taste, satisfaction from food taste. And so, you know, one of the things I've suggested is that you take your diet and kind of do some trade-ups in quality or nutrition, depending upon your goals. And one way to trade up would be to compare, compare a steak from the Safeway with a steak from a source like this. And just look at the price difference, eat both, make some comparisons. And that's something you could do without turning anything in, but it would also be a good thing to do, you know, turn in a journal assignment if you want to. Okay. Questions on this? Maybe we could all go in and just have a big meat festival. Okay. Any food news from any of you guys? See, that was my crowd cow. I was very excited about that. A Foley librarian I work with a lot, Linda Pierce, has put together a little research page for us. And there's some pretty cool stuff on here. I went right, as many of you would like to do, I went right to the streaming video because there's some really cool stuff there. Slow Food Revolution is very good. I happened to watch that. So I'll just kind of call that to your attention. Food Inc. showed up there. Just Eat It showed up there. So I'd like you to think about doing an optional short research paper. I'm going to try to entice you with some topics now that we're this far into philosophy of food. They could be very experiential, like the crowd cow thing, or they could be more theoretical. So I'll start a little list today. Some of them come out of our work, but we are going to talk about the slow food movement later in the reading schedule. So Slow Food Revolution, it does a pretty good job of talking, kind of broadening that discussion to talk about the eco-gastronomic movement. I mean, you want to know about eco-gastronomy. Okay, so, and then I was put in last term for a conference on philosophy of food. This will be my first philosophy of food conference. So if you're curious about what a conference proposal looks like from a philosopher in that, you're welcome to check that out. I won't spend time on it now. Okay, so we talked about civility in food. So that's what I had. Anything else? Did any of you have food topics that you recalled? Food curiosities, questions? Okay, are we good? Okay, we'll try for Thursday maybe. So let's get into our work a little bit. I sent out that worksheet. Let's talk about this. I'm thinking about moving us away from quizzes in the second half of the term. Does that sound like a reasonable? hopefully you saw from the first half of the term that reading, doing consistent reading for class makes a difference. That's an old lesson. So what we'll do this time, in the second half, if we need to do quizzes, we'll do them. But I think you guys are reading pretty well. And really, we should be focusing more on, like, synthetic skills, things that kind of build, like, our short writing exercise. So one thing I'd like to do that I signaled a little bit with our nutrition chapters is to use worksheets. So did some of you fill out the worksheet that I sent out? Yeah. Okay, good. I'm not just trying to think about, maybe get your advice about the best way to do this. So I was thinking if I get the protein one, I think is just to practice. We'll just, if you want credit for it, we'll figure out a way to get you credit for it. But what I thought I'd do is try to get you questions. We're going to do our nutrition chapters on the Tuesdays in the new schedule. Let's just kind of figure this out. Oops. So yeah, going into late March, and we're doing proteins today, carbs next Tuesday, fats the Tuesday after, and then vitamins, I think. Do we wait a week for vitamins? Okay. So here's my suggestion. Tell me what you think of this. I could get you the worksheet questions prior to the class, and then I would probably sample a couple of your answers from that question on a Google form. So if you do the answers on a word processor, then what you would do is just cut and paste whichever ones I asked for into the Google form. Does that sound right? And I wouldn't really be grading them so much. I mean, since it's a worksheet, you probably got the right answers. I would just mostly be giving you credit for doing it. Does that sound, getting some nods? Does that sound, you can nod a little more? You could turn up your nonverbal a little more. Smile, any smiles out there? Smile, come on. We're back to work here. Yeah, it's good.
Just on those questions, about how long do you want the answers?
That's a good question. Some of them involve like some computations, and just look at the protein one. Some of them can be done with lists. I think with this, I'm not. Don't force it into a paragraph. If a list will work, do that. If it's a calculation, just do the numbers. One would be pretty short. You know, you could go into some of those of you who have more of a science background might go further with number one. We'll do this one today in class. How about that? We'll use this as a practice one. Should we do that? And then, so that means you wouldn't get credit from this one, but we've got three more, four more coming. Carbs, fats.
I'm sorry, where, can you show us where we're submitting this?
I would need to make a Google form, so it doesn't exist yet. I'll send you an email about it, but it'll be something like the way I was thinking about this one, but I really want your advice. I mean, I would say maybe send me your answers to 3 and 5. Does that sound like a reasonable approach? And then, even if you didn't do all 5 of them, presumably you'd have time to go back and do the one that you missed that I asked for. But so it's not so much a test. It's just kind of a way to give you credit for being engaged with the material. And are we good on that? So we'll probably make that due before the class on that material. Okay. And it's something, obviously, you should do on your own. It would be pretty easy to cheat on. And I'd see identical phrasing. I don't know what to do about that. Okay, does that work? Any thoughts on that? Yes?
How would we submit our answers if we don't bring a computer to class?
Oh, right. Okay, so let's work this out. So I was thinking, for this, I was thinking you get the question, say, on Thursday for a Tuesday class, and then you get the form also early. So you could do it all before class. That's good. Thanks. Yeah. Okay. Anything else? You guys are quiet. Should we do jumping jacks or something? I got all hyped up for class. You guys are all real mellow. Okay. Let's go ahead and get into our work. And I'll leave that up because I think we're going to come back to that. But we have some other things to talk about first. Okay, so just a quick overview. You don't have to take notes on this. Just kind of remind you of where we've been and kind of where we're headed. We've given some philosophical analyses of food culture. Montanari is kind of one of my guys for that, I guess, I would go to. We've done some critiques of the U.S. food system. We've looked at a couple of people. Pollan is probably our most prominent. People talking about what healthy eating involves. Some of you have worked with the U.S. Dietary guidelines in your diet review journals. which have been great, by the way. I caught up on the last, I think we had about 12 to 15, maybe 17 of you do the first stage of this diet review thing. Great results. I really thank you for sharing your diet experience, your food experiences with me. This is really, really valuable to me. Whether you did that first step, which was a 5% of your grade, informal, you could still do the second one, which is kind of, which invites you to make a change in your diet and then think about that change. And many of you doing the first step kind of had things like you wanted to work on sugar, salt consumption. Maybe some of you were going to try to reduce meat. Some of you wanted to explore plant-based protein dishes. So your issues could be nutritional or gastronomic. Some of you are looking into traditional foods from your family background, your ethnic background. There's just a wide range of diet modifications you can do for the second step. You can do the second phase if you didn't do the first. Mine, actually, I just started yesterday. I might have mentioned this to you before the break. I wanted to work on my protein intake because older people have a little trouble making protein available. So I'm just hammering protein these days. I just started like yesterday. It's great. It's like we'll talk about it when we talk about the protein chapter, because that might be a modification some of you would think about whether you want to adjust your protein. Okay, so we looked at some anthropology and history. We did a lot of work. I don't know if I would, I'm going to survey you guys at the end of the term. I don't know if I would do this much reading next time around, but I hope you valued it. On the human experience with soil and agriculture, right? You got a sense of the history of where some foods come from. We talked about, we got an overview of ethics of food. We're going to be doing more of that in the second half. We talked a little bit about religion and food. We did some work on U.S. food culture, both in the colonial period and in the 19th century era with the Kellogg and the spas and things like that, and the food communities, like the Transcendentalists, remember, and the Shakers. And then in this first part of the course, there was some practical work on diet review, analytic writing, in your short writing experiences. Okay, so then in the second half of the class, we're going to get into a lot more detail on nutrition. I meant to make this a little bit longer. Let's just kind of take a look at the reading list, I guess. So we're gonna march through a few chapters of that nutrition textbook, but you notice like Dan Barber is a really interesting character. He's a Tufts English graduate who became a world famous chef, not the kind that you see on TV shows, but he runs Blue Hills Restaurant, which is a famous farm-based restaurant in New York. I think it costs something like $200 or $300 per person to eat there. It's supposed to be a really special experience. I don't know if I could justify that, but okay. And so his writing on food is really interesting because he's writing as a chef who's very well educated and thinking about a lot of the issues you guys think about when you think about food, like ecology, sustainability, localism. And so his book, The Third Plate, is excerpting a section of it which wound up in a best food writing collection. So Dan Barber is kind of going to take us into some issues about the taste of bread, taste and quality of bread. He's going to take us into some really great stories involving terroir. Am I pronouncing that right? Any French experts in here? Terroir. Terroir refers to it's an interesting concept. It refers to the local culture that produces especially unique foods. So there's a terroir for jambon ibérico, right? Is this really famous Spanish ham, jambon, right? And, or I guess, no, that wouldn't be the Spanish. Okay, anyway, Spanish ham. And this ham is incredibly prized, and so he goes into the story of that. There's a story about bread that actually involves Washington State. We're going to read about a really interesting guy who is working on bread. So anyway, what I'm trying to get at is that Dan Barber takes us into gastronomy. He takes us into stories about food from a gastronomical taste perspective, but also from a kind of ecological perspective, if you would. Not so much, about pollution, but the local ecology. Terroir is a way of getting at the local ecology. So, for instance, there's a terroir for Northwest beer, right? That would be an example. There's a terroir for tuna in the Mediterranean. I had a chance when I was woofing 2 years ago. My host took me to an old tunery, which is an elaborate way of harvesting tuna using these underground nets. It's really pretty fascinating. So there's a anyway, we're going to get into gastronomy in the second half of the semester. We're also going to read about more food science. Now here, the Moss book is going to be less about food politics and regulation, but more about food science and engineering, how food products are engineered, industrial food products are engineered. So we're not done with industrial food products. And then late, by mid-April, we're getting into the slow food story, which is about food culture and a critique of fast food culture. And you'll read the Italian origins of the slow food movement. We could do a little more of nutrition. And then we're really into our ethics unit. I've kind of been putting off, I kind of put this off till the end of the end of the course, but I've mentioned that all diets are philosophical diets in the sense that they all involve a conception of where you fit in to the ecosystem, where you fit into the industrial system, how your choices reflect values that you hold. And I want to approach the choice of a philosophical diet pretty deliberately. I think it's, and non-judgmentally, I really think it's a very personal thing to decide on a philosophical diet. Right now, you inherited, before you took this course, you could say your philosophical diet was the diet that you inherited by default from your culture, and right? And so you could think of this course as giving you resources to kind of rethink your philosophical commitments on your diet. I have no agenda about what kind of a diet you should wind up with when you think about the philosophical questions behind a diet, but there are profound questions, and there are philosophically profound reasons for choosing one diet over another. Given that any diet choice you make has implications for values, you know, has implications for what you care about, and is a statement about you, I just think it's kind of a personal process. So in the end of the course, I'd like us to go through some pretty in-depth ethical discussions about what it's okay to eat, and whether those, and whether those discussions have a pull on, and that can have to do with what you eat, it can have to do with how you eat, and it can have to do with how you source what you eat. So there's all kinds of dimensions to that. So that's kind of where we'll finish up the course. Okay, within that, one reason for highlighting where we're going here is because I want to encourage you to make some choices of additional topics. So there's the diet improvement track. Some of you are choosing some of these topics. I've had a few good conversations with people about some of these topics, but I'm also going to suggest others starting today that I hope I can get some of you to jump on. There's just, you know, what happens with... What comes up for me a lot in studying food is things that just don't exactly make sense. Like one person will say one thing and another person will say another thing. For example, if you listen to vegetarians, they will say all proteins are equal. If you listen to a lot of nutritionists, they'll say proteins really vary in quality. So there you have something to kind of look into. There's a kind of a dispute of evidence. And I'll try to signal some other ones. Okay, you guys are quiet. I need to get you talking. Oh my God. Let's see. How do we do this? Let's take 2 minutes with the Gratzer. Could you pull up the Gratzer piece? I want to ask you some questions about that. Could you just flip through that on your screens? Or if you have a print copy with you, could you look at that? Just remind yourself of that. There's not too much I need from that, but I wanted to kind of start there. some more. All right, let's take a look at the Gratzer chapter, okay? And really, you know, by the way, on the quiz, just to get back to the quizzes real quick, they do actually motivate reading. I mean, one of the consistent survey results I've done with previous semesters is to ask in a SurveyMonkey question, did the presence of quizzes make you more likely to prepare for class? And we get numbers in like the 90% range, right? So one of the things I'd like you to consider is, you know, whether we can do that without the quizzes, whether we can get that point across, whether you can, you know, because I know that you guys have things. How many of you are graduating this? Yikes, oh my God, yeah, right. So that's going to be a big distraction. How are you approaching that? Is that feeling pretty good? Are you excited about that? No, it feels really weird, doesn't it? Spring semester with upper division classes always has this kind of like, I get the feeling, well, I mean, you're moving into, you're making this huge transition, so I always feel like I'm losing my okay. There are, yeah, well, I'll get into that another time. Oh, yeah, I didn't get that ready for you today. Okay. All right, let me try and go through what I found interesting about this, and then I'd like to invite you to chime in with things from the article that you found helpful or interesting. Here's my biggest, let's start our notes here. What does this article show us? I've got like four things that I think are the general significance of this article. One is, this gives us an image of a moment in nutrition science, right? Let's just think about what the article really covers. It gives us the story of these two British scientists, both women, going to Vienna and encountering a largely male experts, but they're not unfamiliar with them. They know them. It's all part of this scientific community. This is an early 20th century. World War I is on. And you're witnessing a moment of, we'll call attention to it in great detail. I've identified it as big moments. We're witnessing some big moments in which we're understanding nutrition-based diseases. So that's the first significance. This article gives us a rich image of a moment of understanding of nutrition. And I want to point out that this is 1919, right? We're getting into the mid-20th century, and we're just figuring out what causes the main nutrition-based diseases, right? Let's go get them in your notes. Scurvy, beriberi, and rickets. I always have trouble keeping them straight, so I gave you some wiki page notes here to get them sorted out. So let's get this in your notes while we're here. Scurvy is the one that is a deficiency of vitamin C. It was endemic on ships and among sailors. It's, you can read the symptoms are gross for all these, actually. It's horrible. Beriberi is a vitamin B1 deficiency. It's, what are there's images, if you want to go to the wiki pages while you're sitting there, you're welcome to. You can get images of what a person looks like if they have this disease. It's pretty horrible. Beriberi is often noticed in the thinness of, is this the one that shows itself in the thinness of skulls? No, rickets does, right. So beriberi is it's a B1 deficiency, and it was especially noticed, this is a good detail to add, this comes up in the article, it was especially noticed in cultures that had perfected polishing of rice. Remember we talked about brown rice versus white rice. So white rice needs to be enriched with vitamin B1 in order to avoid beriberi or to contribute to it. Rickets are going to be front and center in the article you read for today. And rickets are really, it's a horrible bone degeneration disease, bone disease, and it affects the way calcification occurs in bones, and it's the absence of vitamin D especially, but also phosphorus or calcium. And it literally leads to bowl-leggedness in children and adults. It leads to soft tissue. You got the detail, the historic detail of ancient warriors who find that in a battle they find that the opponents had skulls that were thin, because they had rickets. They had a deficiency in calcium production. Okay, so one thing I like about this article is it gives you this image of a moment of understanding of nutrition-based diseases, but it also reminds us that we were still trying to understand nutrition-based diseases into the middle of the 20th century, into the second third of the 20th century. Okay, second thing, it's great. It gives you a great image of science and gender, right? Did any of you pick up on this when you're reading about this? You've got an article about a woman, Harriet Chick, who's partly, partly the war's on, so a lot of men are off fighting the war, and she's a scientist in a time when women are not taken seriously as much as scientists, and there are a lot of stories about that. And she goes to this very male science culture, and she shows them by going into their clinics that she's right, that these are diet-based diseases. And the competitor, well, we'll get into the story. That's one thing. That's the second thing, is that this is an interesting story about science and gender. Third thing, there's a real food justice issue here. Did you guys notice that? Who's affected by these dietary diseases? I mean, it's the poor, right? So you read in this article that up to 40% of the population of London and Great Britain had rickets. And this became a huge problem when they were trying to recruit for the war effort, because you can't have an army of soldiers who have bowl legs and whose bones are fragile, right? So the social justice issue that we're seeing here is that nutritional diseases disproportionately affect the poor, and we're going to see that in the U.S. cases put in your notes too. Okay, so the general point is that nutritional diseases disproportionately affect the poor, and then add in as a note in contemporary U.S. culture, this is also true, right? Who suffers the most from the Western diet? It's actually poor people, because they're the ones who have to buy the cheapest calories available, right? You guys are from the socioeconomic class generally, not exclusively, but most of you, this was my background growing up, where we could afford better quality food. So this article broaches a kind of social justice issue that we have a modern version or a very contemporary version of. So are the poor people today, does this make sense? Poor people today aren't suffering from scurvy, beriberi, and rickets. Poor people today are suffering from what? You guys know this.
Obesity,
diabetes, metabolic syndrome, heart disease, dietary-related heart disease. So it's kind of the same story, different illnesses. Kind of interesting. Kind of discouraging, really. Okay, fourth thing. This article really helps you see why we're so committed to milk subsidies. Milk subsidies are a huge distortion of the market, in the food market in this country. But one reason we're so committed to them is that milk subsidies help us avoid rickets and rickets primarily. And milk is a great source of nutrition. So let's go ahead and get into the article just with a few details. So those are any other themes or things that you took from the article that you want to call attention to? Might be details. You go through this page through it and see if there's some details you want to. So I just won't take that long. I just wanted to kind of rehearse the story. So the article opens with Harriet Chick and this other woman, Elise Sidal-Yell, going to Vienna, and you learn that von Pirquet is the Viennese expert and so they have a dispute. This is the point for your notes. The Viennese guy thinks rickets is an infectious disease, and Harriet thinks it's a nutritional disease. And they don't believe her at all. In fact, she gives this talk when she wins an award, mentioned on page 6. She says when she was given this prize in 1974, wow, she must have been much older, right? She says that people just received our message that vitamin deficiency was a cause of these diseases with polite incredulity. There was only one man who believed what we were saying. It was this Professor Venkebach. And he was a heart specialist. But the interesting thing about Venkebach is that he had experienced beriberi in the East Indies. So he was somehow more open to the possibility that she was right. And so what happened, so here's the big moments, right? Let's get them into our record, into your notes. She goes into the infantile scurvy ward at this hospital in Vienna, and she mixes up a diluted concentration of vitamin C, and the infants get better immediately, right? So she demonstrates to them that, now I don't know, this would be an interesting thing for somebody to look up. Maybe somebody could look up the date that we actually isolated vitamin C. I don't think she knows it's vitamin C. Could somebody look that up? When did we actually isolate vitamin C? I think it was Linus Pauling who isolated vitamin C. I'm not sure. That would be, because she knows it works. She knows that lemon juice works. And so she knows it's something in the food, but I don't think they've. Anybody come up with a date for vitamin C? Okay, that's fine. I'll find it. The vitamin chapter's got a lot of this stuff on it. Okay, so they go into the scurvy ward, infantile scurvy ward, big moment there. Then they go into a ward where there's a patient suffering from this keratomalacia, ulceration of the cornea, which is related to vitamin D deficiency. So it's actually an effect of rickets. And she saves the patient's sight. This is also, rickets also affected military, it caused something called night blindness. Because if you have a vitamin D deficiency, your eyesight it deteriorates. And that shows up especially in your night vision, right? So that's another big moment. And at this point, cod liver oil gets identified as one of the huge. I wanted to show you just how powerful cod liver oil is. Okay, so this is a teaspoon of cod liver oil, 4 grams. Oops. Well, I'm not seeing nutrition. Wait a minute. That's funny. Maybe I need to get picture. There it is. Okay. So let's do a teaspoon. Cod liver oil. Actually, my parents tried to get me to drink cod liver oil. Cod liver oil is horrible stuff. They say in the article that they found a way to make it less smelly. It's fish oil. I mean, it's literally you squeeze the liver of the cod. And so it would come in these little jars, and it was considered like a miracle vitamin. And it was, in a sense. And this is in the 1960s and 70s, okay? So a teaspoon of cod liver oil is all you need to get your vitamin D. So you can see how powerful it might have been as a food supplement. Okay, questions about this? Feel free to jump in. Make some more interesting. Okay, so then the rickets baby study. Now this is a clinical study they decided to do. She and her partner stayed there for I think the better part of a year. And what if you could just flip to page 7 here and follow this with me, it shows a little bit of the complexity of nutrition studies. So what they do is they decide to try to address rickets across Vienna, right? And what they're going to do is try to really get a clearer idea of what works. So they have, and you get a sense maybe from this reading that at this point nutrition science is pretty approximate. Like, so a good nutrition scientist is basically trying different foods out on people under different conditions. And it could be the foods. Remember, vitamin D is also stimulated by sunlight on your skin, right? But there's a lot of ways you can go wrong. So let's just follow the study and kind of try to appreciate the complexity of studying nutrition. So they set up a clinical trial, and they've got the von Pirquit diet, which is enriched with supplements containing vitamin D. The control group gets the diet without supplements. But here's the the fortunate group gets Harriet Chick's diet, which is full cream, milk powder, and cod liver oil, right? Loaded with protein and vitamin D. And the results are so dramatic that they end the trial. This is the point for your notes, right? That in the clinical trial, Harriet Chick's remedy is dramatically effective, so effective that it seems inhumane to keep the kids on the other two diets. So it's a very dramatic moment when you end a trial because the results are so startling that you just can't keep going, right? And the point about complexity is this. Von Pirquit's diet had vitamin D in it, but he got the vitamin D from cows that were fed poor quality grain. And so the cows had vitamin D, but not the amounts that you saw in, like, the cod liver oil, you know? So the point for your notes would be that you can have the right substance in a lower quality form and get thrown off because it's not powerful enough to produce the effect. So von Pirquit was right. He's on the right track. But Chick combined full cream milk powder with cod liver oil, so she was just blowing the socks off the patient's vitamin D levels, right? Okay. There's a lot in the history. You know, we don't have time to read the whole Gratzer book. It's a pretty cool book because each chapter has lots of examples of how nutrition science goes wrong in really understandable ways. I'll give you one more example for your notes, okay? And then we'll move on a little bit. In the same section, you learn that. That some theorists thought that rickets really was a lack of fresh air and exercise, right? So that turns out to be wrong, right? It's not a lack of fresh air and exercise. However, a lot of people in London were getting rickets, and the smog in London at this time would have been so thick that it would have actually blocked sunlight, and they wouldn't be getting fresh air. And a lot of poor kids in London didn't get a lot of exercise. But here's the point, right? What makes the difference isn't going outside and getting exercise and fresh air. What makes the difference is getting out in the sun, right? Because the sunlight is going to stimulate vitamin D production. So the point is that it's really easy. Make sure this is clear in your notes. It's really easy to go wrong in thinking about nutrition and vitamins because factors are complex. It's not just even about food. Vitamin D is also about it's about sunlight. So it's easy to confuse it with, you know, not getting enough exercise. Okay? So that kind of comes up there. So then they start making industrial production of cod livers, and they find out halibut livers have even more, tuna livers have even more, and that's a happy nutrition story. Okay? Is there a little more detail here? Let's see. Oh, right, yeah, so then you get the last segment of the chapter is really a different story, right? This is a story about Robert McCants, and this has some really cool stuff in it, actually, I forgot about this. You wonder if they have a romance. When you guys read this, did you think that he and Elsie were just, it seems like they're just research partners. But she brings a lot of sophistication. She goes into his lab, basically. They start to become collaborators. They become collaborators for a long time. And she basically goes in with higher analytic skills. She's critical of some of his lab skills. And again, women are still a very small minority of scientists. She was part of a class of 100 that had only 3 women in it. All right, so what do you need to know about McCants and Widdowson? They're the people, first, in her background, again, this is about the time. So it's 1933, and she's just finished some work in a lab that separated the amino acids out for the very first time. So the point for your notes, again, vitamin science is very recent. It's had a long, torturous path. It comes late to the party. And it's only in the first quarter of the 20th century that we even understand protein at the level of amino acids. But the other story connected with this couple, these researchers, is that they're the people who come up with the first book of chemical composition of food. So, for instance, the website that we go to now, you know, for this kind of information, Nutrition Data Self or whichever one you use, that's funny, those didn't load right. That's kind of the modern successor version. So it's 1940, and this is the first effort you have at sort of saying what's chemically in foods. Okay, and then the last few details here. Did anybody find this interesting if you got to the end of the chapter? The last few details have to do, and this comes up again in nutrition science a lot. We'll be talking about some of this in other chapters. It's not unusual for, you don't need to take notes on this. It's not consequential as far as I can tell, but a lot of nutrition scientists engaged in self-experimentation. And do you remember these details? I'm going to remind you of some of these details. So,
one of them said he was like,
yeah, you got it?
I remember one, he kept like breathing in and out really deeply for like 45 minutes.
Right.
And then he like passed out because of all the alkaline in his blood.
Right.
Because it like messed with his blood components. So
yeah.
Essentially like turned blue.
Absolutely. And so there are nutrition scientists in the 17th and 18th century who die because of their experiments. But they're trying to, like, one of the ways that we figure out nutrition is by altering our own diets. And I don't want to encourage you guys to do any extreme nutrition experiments on yourself. But really, the diet review and improvement assignment is sort of inviting you to make small changes and then see if you can notice differences. In this case, here he's trying to figure out how salt is related to water loss, right? So you guys all know, right, that you can reduce, how does that work? You reduce perspiration by taking in beverages that have some salt in it, is that right? So we didn't know that yet. So to discover that, he does this over-breathing. And then there was another study that involved climbing extreme physical exercise. And here's what they're trying to figure out. They're trying to figure out what is a healthy diet. What do you need? And they need to know that because there's wars going on and they need to have rations for the soldiers and for the people back home. They need to know that because if you don't know that, you can't solve nutrition-based malnutrition. And so nobody, the point for your notes would, this is the point for your notes, it's the mid-20th century and we still don't know what a basic healthy diet is, okay? So a lot of nutrition science, studying the social history of nutrition science is about really appreciating just how crude our understanding of a healthy diet. So when we were ragging on the food pyramid and making fun of it and talking about how confused policymakers were in the 70s and 80s and trying to give people good advice, remember all that? We did get the nonverbal, good, okay, remember that? So 30 years before that, you couldn't find a scientist who could tell you what a healthy diet consisted of. We didn't, put it in your notes this way, we didn't have the basic minimum nutrients for a healthy diet. And so some of these self-experiments involved eating really minimal diets, and then, or no, in this case, so this is Widdowson and McCants, and so this is the couple, right? And this is where I think they might have been more than just researchers, because this is a pretty extreme thing to do to somebody. They lived for 3 months on a restricted intake of meat, cheese, sugar, and jam, far below what was then regarded as adequate, but with unlimited quantities of potatoes and bread, which does sound like a lot of fun, doesn't it? Okay, so I know. So that's extreme nutrition research involved excess and deprivation combined with lots of really weird exercise or efforts to, I won't digress on this too much, efforts to capture bodily fluids so that you know what fluid needs people have. Anyway, there's a lot of other stories connected with, we'll run across some of them. Okay. And then you get this happy, you know, there are some happy details, but at the end of all this, they understand that you need to give young mothers fresh milk, orange juice, cod liver oil. And in London, they start doing this, you know, delivering that to people's doorsteps. Is anybody familiar with, I just reminded me, you know, the warnings that you guys are familiar with, warnings against, say, alcohol consumption for pregnant women. Those are pretty recent. Those, when I was a kid, those didn't exist. So anyway, that's our history our nutrition history for today. Okay. Questions about that? You have to leave?
Yeah.
All right, take off. Okay, let's get into the protein chapter a bit. And maybe we can just start with the worksheet that a bunch of you did, and we'll kind of take that through the chapter, or these questions, the worksheet questions. So, and here I'd like to invite the science, those of you who have a greater depth in science, to kind of maybe come forward and volunteer a little more detail. I've got a couple of maybe fairly obvious goals in taking us through nutrition chapters. I mean, I want us to get more depth in nutrition knowledge. One of the things I like about these chapters is that each one of them gets into practical food and diet issues. So we're going to see that with the protein chapter. So what are proteins? Let's just start there. What are proteins chemically? Amino acids, right? And what do you want? What should we know about amino acids? What's important to know about amino acids? This is the filter I want us to use on all of these chapters, because there's a lot more detail in these chapters than we absolutely need to learn. But there's a lot in here that... So what do we need to know? What's important to know about amino acids?
Nitrogen.
What?
Nitrogen.
Yeah, I found that interesting. That was a detail I picked up here. So when you're taking up protein, 16% of the protein is nitrogen. So that relates back to our discussion of nitrogen in the soil too, right? Yeah. But what about these amino acids? Are they all the same? No. Take us into this. Yeah.
There's different ones in all different kinds of foods.
Yeah. So what do you really want to key on? Can your body make all of these 20 amino acids? Is that you want to do this for us?
There's 8 essential amino acids that the body can produce that you need to consume from your diet.
Yeah.
And it's like you have to synthesize them.
Good.
Recycle from other cellular components, but beyond that, the other ones you can synthesize because there are other intermediates from other functions your body does. But
right. Good. So the point for your notes is that there are 9 essential amino acids, and they're essential because you can't make them. There's a little complexity here. I don't want to miss opportunities for us to appreciate complexity, because you do get into... It's not like a strict distinction, because there are some of the so-called dispensable ones that if you don't have them, then there's others that you can't make. So the example would be that the body can make cysteine from methionine. But if your diet is deficient in methionine, it can't make cysteine. So the point is that while there's 9 that you definitely need from your diet, there's others that you might or might not be able to make if depending upon which others you have. Okay, so does that start to give you a picture of this? And then visually, it might be helpful to notice that okay, good. So this is a good example, because we can contrast two. So I need to reload. Let's reload chickpeas. How about that? So here are your 9 essential amino acids. And notice they've combined M and C. That's the example I was just giving you. Because those are you don't need both of them, but if you don't have one, you can't make the other, right? So this has this is the lowest amino acid score you can have. Cod liver oil is great for you, but it doesn't have it doesn't have any protein, as you can tell from that, right? Okay, so then if you go to something like chickpeas, you learn that these protein scores basically are what you read about in your chapter. When people talk about protein quality, they're talking about whether you have all the essential ones, all 9, and whether you have them in the proportions that your body can make the most efficient use of them, right? So a score over 100 on this nutrition data site indicates a complete protein because it has all 9 and it's a relatively high quality. I think a score of like 140 is a really high score. So you can see chickpeas are a complete protein in that sense. Okay, and there's more about protein quality that you can read there. But then later in the chapter you may have read that. Oops, let's see if we can do this again. in the chapter, you may have read that chickpeas and sesame seeds form a complete protein, right? So there's some other ones like beans and rice is the most famous one, right? Now the dietary advice on this is changing, and you see this a little bit in this chapter. But I first want to point out a puzzle, which is part of why I suggested protein quality would be an interesting thing to research. The sesame seed protein quality is still pretty good. It's much lower than the chickpeas, so it's a little bit weak in this one. And I think so. There's two possibilities. Well, there's a couple possibilities here, but one possibility is that chickpeas are complete, and you don't need to add sesame seeds. Another possibility is that there's more information than we're seeing here, and that you could supplement, that a dish that had chickpeas would be made more nutritionally complete from a protein perspective if you added sesame seeds, right? So the practical point to take away here is to think about complete proteins. And in your chapter, that's discussed especially on page 52. You could just flip to that. So the traditional, put in your notes this way, the traditional advice on complete and incomplete proteins was that if you were not eating animal protein, you needed to combine plant proteins to make complete proteins. So that's one piece of advice. That's out there. That's still pretty traditional advice. And you read it, you come across it in food writing. You know, try to, if you're on a vegetarian diet especially, so you're not getting animal protein, try to complement your protein so that you're getting all nine in the proportion that you need. The other kind of advice that you get later in the chapter is, there's a lot of information about dietary guidelines for vegetarian and vegan diets in this chapter. And the authority they cite later in the chapter says, you don't really need to balance proteins in the dish, you just need to balance them over the period of a day, right? So there's two different schools of thought about protein balancing, and that's especially relevant if some of you, even though you have meat-based diets, you've indicated in your journals that you might want to move a little bit away from that. So this would be relevant if you're going to experiment with plant-based protein as a way of reducing your consumption of meat. Some of you have said that's a goal for you. Feel free to interrupt with questions. Okay. So let's get back to our sheet here. Let's see how we're doing with that. Okay, so we know what proteins are. We understand the crucial difference between the nine essential amino acids. Let's see. What are some of the major processes in protein and metabolism and functions of protein in the body? So let's make it a list. Let's hear what list you came up with. This is a case where I think I invited a list. Can we just read off some of yours? Yes, please.
Tissue building,
good.
pH balance,
good.
Water balance.
There's a whole chapter in this nutrition textbook on water balance. Very fascinating topic. Again, think systematically. We're not just talking about getting ingredients that you need. We're talking about affecting metabolic processes like water balance, pH balance, nitrogen balance. What else?
Immunity.
Yeah, it can affect your protein deficiency. Can affect your immune system. Absolutely. Yeah. Good. You have this protein deficiency disease called kwashiorkor. Very strange name. I was looking it up because it's such a weird word. Did anybody else run across that? Okay. Okay, so there's also a role that proteins play in metabolism and transportation of other nutrients, transportation of fats and other nutrients. Okay, so then we got into the vegetarian diet. Ah, this is an interesting issue. I really would like something. Here's a puzzle that I would like us to speculate about a bit. That's an utterly illegible word. Did any of you find it interesting that in this chapter that there's a little segment on American overconsumption of protein. Did you guys notice that? So we Americans average about 180% of their protein needs. We are really a high protein culture. And here I am starting this 30-day, you know, protein supplement diet. So I'm into it, you know. I'm going to see if protein, I'm going to invite you guys to do this in your diets. I'm testing the hypothesis that because of my age and the bioavailability of protein in my diet is lower, and because I'm meeting, well, I'll show you this when we go through our calculations together, my hypothesis is that I'm getting enough protein by measurement in my diet, but it's not bioavailable to me, so I'm going to jack up my protein by 30 grams a day, which is just going to smoke that level up. You know, it's just like go from the minimum to the maximum. And I'm going to try and notice over 4 weeks if it has an effect. So that's kind of an example of a dietary change. Do you guys have any... I did a little Googling on this, a little bit of research. Do you guys have any hypotheses about why Americans overconsume protein? There's some literature on psychology of protein. I mean, how... We've talked about this briefly, how you feel after a real high protein meal. Any thoughts about that? Try to think about how protein feels in your diet. Yeah?
Well, I always just attributed it to meat consumption. Like you were saying that the difference between like traditional Italian cuisine and like American Italian, there's way more meat.
Right.
I figured something.
So you could say, well, we don't really care about the feeling of the protein, we just like the meat. That's a good hypothesis, good. Yeah, let me think about that. I'm assuming we like the protein feeling, but maybe you're right. Maybe it's just that we just like meat and dairy, and that's loaded with protein. So that would be a hypothesis. We're not choosing a lot of protein. We're choosing a lot of meat and dairy. Good. Yeah, others? Yeah.
I think it's also like the whole, like, bigger is better. Mentality where it's like, you know, eating, like, a lot of food, like kind of we talked about in the last...
Yeah.
First half of the semester, I was just like, I can eat a, you know, half pound steak or I can eat a 2 pound steak at a restaurant.
Right.
Those people will go for the bigger option.
Yeah. Right. You remind me, Crowd Cow has these 32-ounce steaks, and they say, oh, it'll feed 2 people. And I'm like, oh, my God, a 32-ounce steak can feed, like, 8 people. What are you talking about? Well, it depends on your consumption. So, yeah, so there's another hypothesis. It's like the feeling of overabundance. It's like the feeling of being overfed. It feels great. You feel like everything's satisfied. I ran across a guy who has a fad diet, like a high-protein fad diet, and he goes on and on. He's a psychologist, and he goes on and on about just how you feel really grounded when you have a lot of protein. And that's kind of part of the psychology. Any other thoughts? It is remarkable. It could say, I'm thinking along your lines, it could be that we're just rich enough. You know, we're just a rich enough culture that we can afford to do it. Because protein's relatively expensive as a nutrient. I don't know. I want to think about that some more. Maybe somebody's interested in that. All right, can we do this for five minutes? Can you get into groups and do the two calculations with each other? Some of you have already done this. If you did, just help the person you're in group with do their calculation. I know this involves revealing your weight. If you're sensitive about that, you can do whatever you want. You get to say, we don't have a scale here. So could you just get in groups of 5 minutes and just do both calculations? I'm very curious to see what differences you get between the two methods of calculation, okay? It's in the chapter. If you haven't done it, this is a good time to do it. Page 61.